This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The fossil fuel industry is excited about the possibilities raised by hydraulic fracturing. It's called fracking for short, and it's the process of drilling for natural gas and underground oil. Proponents say fracking could solve our energy problems for years to come, but there's growing concern that it could saddle us with environmental problems for years to come as well. And within the next 2 years, fracking may come to North Carolina. The process releases methane into the atmosphere. It produces millions of gallons of wastewater. And so the question is, are we ready? Do we have the environmental safeguards in place and enough people paid to enforce them? Richard Ziegler's recently been covering fracking debate in the state. His series, Fracking North Carolina, debuted this week on Morning Edition for North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. And Richard Ziegler is an independent reporter and producer and joins us now to talk more about fracking. Richard, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It's good to have you here. So give us again the kind of the elevator talk about what is fracking.
Well, in hydraulic fracturing, you're taking per well probably 3 to 5 million gallons of water. You're mixing it with sand, which is called a proppant, and some chemicals to facilitate the fracking process to make the water slicker in some respects. And some of those chemicals might be biocides and other things to help the process. And you blast it underneath the ground into shale rock. And what happens is that opens up fractures in the shale rock, which releases the gas. And the sand is actually there to go into the little fractures you make and prop them open. That's why they're called proppants. And that ensures that the gas will continue to come out.
Because right now, most of the natural gas we get is in giant pools, little underground lakes of natural gas, real easy to get. Poke a hole in it, up it comes, right?
Right. Well, they're trapped in reservoir rock that's very permeable, so it moves around, exactly. So it's free-flowing, exactly.
And then we've always known that gas gets trapped in these shale beds, little tiny rivulets, and right. Here and there, crevices, really, really hard to get. We haven't touched it, but is this new technology that has allowed us to do this, or changes in the technology that have now made this a more attractive and I guess, a better possibility?
Well, that's a good question. When you talk about fracking or fracturing, proponents of hydraulic fracturing will say this is old technology. It's been around for decades. And it is true that even in this state, we have used hydraulic fracturing, for example, to frack water wells. But we weren't using horizontal drilling, and we weren't using a lot of the types of chemicals and proppants that are used now. So it's a modified process that's relatively new that we're using to get to this shale gas.
Horizontal drilling. So what's going on there?
Right. So they drill down vertically, which is what you do with a conventional well. And then at some point, now they can do directional drilling where they change the drill bit or whatever, and then they go at not exactly a 90-degree angle, but they're able to go up under horizontally. And the reason this is important is so the gas is trapped into this shale rock. Even if you frack it, it's just the gas around where you frack that's going to come out. So the longer you can frack a shale bed, the more gas you get out, and it makes it economically more viable to get the gas out that way. So
let's talk about environmentally some of the concerns we might have. First of all, there are chemicals in the original water, the clean water essentially that goes in.
Right.
We don't know yet what's in those. Right now, there's no federal requirement or state requirement at the moment, is that right, to disclose all the chemicals that are used.
Right. If you're talking about the chemicals that are called fracking fluids that are added to the water when you're fracking, they are generally, it varies state by state, but they're protected as trade secrets. And the level of protection on those trade secrets can vary from state to state. In some states, there might be an organization like DENR or some part of the government that has a list of what they might be. And in some states, the public might even be able to see the chemical families that are in there, but they won't know exactly what the chemicals are.
DENR, Department of Natural Resources, what's the rule here in North
Carolina? Well, they're still trying to figure that out. And Dr. Rao is coming on later, might be able to tell you more about this, but I believe that they do believe in protecting this information as proprietary. Right. And it seems that they're leaning towards releasing information on the chemical families to the public, but not that exact chemicals.
And the fact that we don't have rules yet on this is because we haven't really done it. Not this kind of fracking, not for natural gas, as you suggest, right? We haven't
done that
in North Carolina.
Yeah, we don't have it. We're not, traditionally, we've not been an oil or gas producing state. And a lot of the laws that we do have been on the books since about 1945. And they were kind of just perfunctory laws that were put in place in case we were to become an oil and gas producer.
And now with this new interest, the North Carolina legislature has passed legislation about fracking. What does it do?
Well,
they set this rulemaking process in motion, right?
Right.
Part of what's been allowed.
Right. So last year, I think they gave themselves a 2-year time limit to come up with rules and regulations regarding gas and oil exploration and production before they were going to lift the moratorium on it.
Right, because right now you can't do it. There is a moratorium in the state of North Carolina on this particular process.
Right. So our laws that go back to 19, our original laws outlaw horizontal drilling, for example. So this could not go on with the laws that as they were.
Right. So now we've got sort of a rulemaking process in place designed to allow this new kind of the horizontal fracking to take place. So where else is this happening now? Where is it going on?
Oh, where's hydraulic fracturing? Oh, it's opened up a lot of shale beds. It's Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio. Actually, California is looking at something called the Monterey Shale Bed, and they have not opened it up yet, but they're looking to see if they can regulate that. And that's supposed to end up being a really huge one if they do.
And what kind of experiences have they had in places like West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, what those experiences are like. And Pennsylvania, a lot of people are familiar with the Marcellus shale play. There's been some concern that methane, for example, may have seeped into people's water supplies. On the other hand, you have a lot of people making money. You have a lot of jobs, and that's welcomed in a lot of communities.
So let's talk more about that. We talked about the water that goes in, the fracking water that's used to open up these beds and release the gas. It has some chemicals in. We don't always know what they are. We assume some of them we know from other places that where this has been disclosed that these are hazardous. Some of them are hazardous.
Right.
Then when you use it, it comes out and it's definitely contaminated water. How so?
Well, so they're the original chemicals that were put in it, and then it's going to pick up whatever is in the shale. So if you are in a shale bed that has a lot of radiological material, it'll take some of that out. A lot of the shale plays are actually, when they were originally created millions of years ago, they were in aquatic bodies. So like this one in North Carolina, the Triassic, it was a lake. But I believe the Marcellus was actually formed offshore in the ocean. And what you find in, because of the way they were formed, they have a lot of salts in them. Because ours was formed in freshwater, the salinity is probably not going to be as big a problem as, say, in the Marcellus, but they will pick up salts. And when it comes to then trying to clean up the water, you have to desalinate it as well as take out all, you know, what are these chemicals we put in it and try to clean out radiological material. So
if you're going to use it again, and otherwise you still have to figure out what you're going to do with it.
Right. And a lot of people I interviewed, agree that the best thing to do with it initially is to recycle it for the hydrofracturing process. So it may be that you can use the same fracking fluids over and over and over again, even if they are contaminated with other stuff they pick up in the shale, which is great. But this is not an infinite, there's not an infinite number of wells. And at some point, it has to be disposed of.
Right.
And at that point, you can take a lot of the stuff out. I mean, you can clean the water of a lot of stuff that's in it, but even at that point, you're left with a sludge that's toxic. So there's going to be some waste you have to get rid of.
And you talked about the beds, the places where we suspect it is in North Carolina. Where is that?
The Triassic Basin in North Carolina. Basically, if you think of southwest Granville County and then a little line that goes down from there, goes through Durham County into Moore and Lee County, and comes out at like Anson and Montgomery County. And it just, a lot of Durham is over it, a lot of Durham County. It just barely skirts the edges of, I'd say, Orange and Wake. So it's pretty narrow.
And do we know the geologic impact of this? We're blowing up rocks underground. Does that matter to us up here?
Oh, you know, I've not heard anyone express that concern. I think it's so, and this is, again, something Dr. Rao would probably be better to speak to.
Well, we'll talk more about that and continue our conversation. Richard Ziegler is an independent reporter and producer, recently produced a series, Fracking North Carolina, that debuted this week on WNC's Morning Edition. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at some other perspectives on fracking around the state, find out about the consequences, the potential rewards. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about hydraulic fracturing in North Carolina. And we've been talking with Richard Ziegler, independent reporter and producer, who recently produced a series here on WUNC, Fracking North Carolina. Now, Reich Longest joins us, as well as Vikram Rao. They're both part of the conversation. Reich Longest is a clinical professor and director of environmental law and policy clinic at Duke Law. Vikram Rao is the executive director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium and a former chief technology officer at Halliburton. He's also the chair of the Mining and Energy Commission here in the state of North Carolina. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Pleasure.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Vic, let me start with you and talk about the need for shale gas. Why are we bothering with fracking at all?
Well, it appears that shale gas can be produced very inexpensively. So North America has been the first to do so. And so North America is suddenly feeling very advantaged. So natural gas in North America is about a third of the price in Europe and about a fifth of the price in the Far East. So it puts American industry at an advantage.
And already it's had a huge impact in terms of the price differential between gas and oil, right?
Well, yes, huge. Because right now on an energy content basis, oil is about 4 to 5 times the price of natural gas. So it emboldens natural gas to start displacing oil in a number of areas.
All right. And what about here in North Carolina? What I've seen some estimates that say we don't have much. It looks like a 4 or 5 year supply, perhaps?
I would have to say in North Carolina, we just don't know yet. There's been so little activity that the normal types of exploration that industries do has not been conducted. And when you don't have information, you put a low probability in the estimates. So I would have expected the numbers to be low. If any further exploration happens, I would expect the numbers to go up. Then the question is how much.
And so, and part of what you're doing now as part of the Mining and Energy Commission is coming up with the rules to govern this practice that really we don't know that much about. Is that right?
Right. So the we are directed to make the rules regardless of whether it actually happens. But were it to happen, the rules should be in place to do this securely.
Richard, you have covered hearings around this rulemaking process. What's that been like? What's the tone of those hearings and what are the concerns you hear?
I think the hearings have gone in a pretty orderly way. I mean, there has been concern from some people in the public that they feel like they have not had an opportunity to give a lot of input. But I have to add that they have a question, and they have a little session at the end where people can give their public input, and often people don't sign up for it.
Well, Reich, I want to get a sense of this. So here we are, in a sense, a frontier for North Carolina trying to create these rules and regs about a process that we know something about but not too much in North Carolina. So what do we have? Maybe we can take a look at the regulatory process over time, trying to regulate other industries, environmental regulation in this state. Give us a sense of that, how it's gone.
Well, I think there's some good examples we can look in the past where we've been faced with a new industry coming into the state and we've had to develop regulations around it. A good example of that would be going back 20 to 30 years, we're looking at the growth of the swine industry in North Carolina. We had a revolution in the way in which animals were being raised and being produced in this country. That changed agriculture as we know it. That changed the way that swine were produced, as it had with turkeys and chickens before. And the regulatory apparatus in North Carolina responded very slowly to those industrial changes and actually spent a period of about 10 to 15 years catching up. In the case here with fracking, we do have one important difference, which is, unlike the situation with the hog industry, fracturing started out as being illegal under North Carolina law. That is that we had a ban dating back from the 1940s on anything but vertical drilling. There was a restriction that you could not drill more than 3 degrees off of the vertical. Because that ban was in place, the industry had not done any extensive work here until the legislature then began authorizing this regulatory initiative. I would say, I think right off the bat, that one of the problems that I see is that in the case, for example, with the hog industry, it took about 10 years for the state legislature and for environmental regulators to get it right in terms of what was needed to regulate the hog industry in a way to have meaningful regulatory standards and also to develop the inspection and compliance mechanisms to get hog farms to comply with the regulations that eventually get enacted.
Well, let me ask you, what was going on in those 10 years while they were painting the train down the track?
Well, there were some very notable, visible problems. There was a very large series of hog lagoon failures that highlighted some problems where lagoons had not been constructed in accordance with what the engineering specifications had been and had not been operated and maintained in accordance with the plans that had been prepared. And so you had lagoons that were filling up with waste and were bursting all over the place. Meanwhile, the EMC and the General Assembly were working overtime to try and respond to those. And
EMC is the
Environmental Management Commission.
Sounds like in that case the rules were in place. They didn't have the enforcement capacity to make sure people were following the rules.
That's true, but they also had to keep changing the standards as they found out more about the impacts from the industry as time went on and eventually went to a much more stringent set of standards in this state than we have in other places in the country. But it was an adaptive situation.
Vic?
That's exactly what happened to Pennsylvania with fracking. They started doing the stuff before the regulations were in place that were, or the enforcement was in place that was necessary.
So what have we learned from this? And what, for instance, one of the concerns is that we don't at the moment require companies to tell us all of the chemicals that are in the fracking fluid. Is that something the state of North Carolina is going to address? Should they have to do that? Does there need to be that level of transparency?
Yeah, that rule has not already been written, but there's been enough discussion that we can speak about it. We will require full disclosure of chemicals. And the only exclusion will be for those very, very few specific chemicals that are ordained as trade secret, that the company says are a trade secret. So the vast majority of the chemicals will be disclosed in their full chemistry and everything. A few which are considered to be trade secret. And the reason for a trade secret exclusion, people ask me, why should there be a trade secret exclusion? And the reason that I give is that we are asking the industry to do greener stuff. If they do innovate to do greener stuff, then they should be afforded intellectual property protection, just like you and I are afforded if we do an invention.
But, I mean, is anybody going to know what that trade secret is?
Yes. So the way it's going right now, the rule is not written, is that those trade secret elements will be deposited in a government body, more than likely in DENR, and then be made accessible in very rapid fashion when required by emergency responders or health or physicians.
What about the question of the wastewater coming out? What do we do with that?
Yeah. The wastewater coming out, in fact, a small clarification. I don't chair the whole commission. I chair the Water and Waste Committee.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Nevertheless, the wastewater coming out, as Richard pointed out, the smartest thing to do and something that we'll come close to legislating, but we'll certainly say it's the most desirable option, is to reuse the water. But as he pointed out, at some point, you can't use it anymore. So then we would advocate that you treat it for some purpose, treat it for discharge, for agricultural purposes. Keep in mind, North Carolina has a number of industrial wastewater effluent that is currently treated and handled in some way.
Now, Richard, you had someone in one of your earlier pieces who talked about this wastewater being applied and it with disastrous results.
Right. That was an experiment by the Forest Service in West Virginia, and but the reality is, I'm assuming that if North Carolina decides land application is how they're going to do it, that it will be treated at some different level than this was.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, DINR experts will be looking into what exactly the specification would be that would allow it. And I also lean towards such treatment happening in purpose-built facilities, not in municipal water facilities, which are not, which we found in Pennsylvania, are not fit to handle it.
Right. Is this a question of how and not whether? Do you think fracking can be done safely if all these things are in place or fracking should not be done at all?
Well, fracking is being done. So the question of whether it will be done at all, it's being done in other states.
In other states, not North Carolina.
That's right.
So that the question for North Carolina is
whether here and when,
yeah,
and under what circumstances. The question of whether I did not read as being conclusively answered by our state in terms of its public opinion. The question, natural gas is a commodity that's available. We are burning gas in this state and in this region that is coming from parts far away in the United States, and we'll continue to do so. I think the biggest issue that I see for allowing fracking in North Carolina is the problem we have with governance right now. When this bill was decided, allocation of funds was made for three positions to oversee this entire operation, including oil and gas development offshore. The resources are just not there to do meaningful regulatory development or inspection and enforcement. It's not consistent, even with recommendations from an independent group such as Stronger, in terms of what was necessary to actually have the kind of good regulatory governance. And it's very difficult to have good governance if you have policymakers and lawmakers who are defining good governance as no government.
Well, as Stronger, by the way, State Review of Oil and Natural Gas Environmental Regulations.
That's correct. That's the acronym. Very good.
And it is a statewide or a national body?
It's a national body, and it was an initiative started by industry, as I understand it, and embraced by EPA, and it also has participation by non-governmental organizations and experts in the field, and they actually look at an entire regulatory scheme, not just the standards, but how
– Or the enforcement. Yeah. No. Without an IRS, I don't pay my taxes. You can send me my bill. If I don't go to jail for not paying them, I'm not paying them. So,
exactly.
Vic, what about that? I mean
– In fact, it's an interesting question you raise because it's something we are considering in committee. I think if we did it the old-fashioned way, which is we had to have an inspector go to every location to do everything, it'll be prohibitive. So I think we have to turn it back on industry to say, we want reporting, but we want it automatic, we want it electronic, we want it wireless, and we want systems enabled so that the enforcement can be done more cost-effectively.
Yeah, but I mean self-reporting?
No, not self-reported. What is to be reported, how frequently reported, will be specified. So, for example, in the case of water, the proximal wells will be baseline tested. What is to be tested will be completely specified, and the frequency of retesting will be specified. No, I'm talking more about when we've specified what you will be reporting, that it be done in a very effective fashion to reduce the burden on the manpower of DINR.
What would that take? Right.
Well, I'll give an example, and this comes back from a previous work that I did with the state of North Carolina. I used to run the underground storage tank program legal enforcement side for a number of years. And what we found there is you have a system that's designed to contain petroleum products. That is, if you own a gas station, you want to keep the gasoline in the tank until you sell it to a customer. It's in your financial interest to do so. You hire an engineer to design a system that's not going to leak accordingly. But as time goes on, due to environmental factors as well as operation and maintenance issues and construction issues, these things leak. And so what we have to have is an inspection and enforcement regime where you can actually do on-the-ground inspection when things are constructed. It's not enough just to have electronic reporting. A good example would be a waste impoundment. If an engineer says a waste impoundment, in order to be protective of this produced water, has to have a clay liner, and then that's covered with a geotex membrane or some other form of protection – you need to have an inspector go out there and actually say, yes, that's 12 inches of clay and that geotex is in place. If you don't, the incentive will be for the contractor, not for the engineer, not necessarily for the company, but for the contractor to skimp. And that's where we see a lot of problems in addition to the operation and maintenance problems. But you really need, in order to have effective governance, you have to have good standards. You have to have construction inspections so that you know that things were built according to the standards. And then the operations and maintenance piece. Now, that's where I think some of what Vic is describing would be very helpful, figuring out ways to have real-time communication so that you can flag things that are operation and maintenance issues. That would definitely be a very big help.
See, real-time communication is commonplace in the oil and gas industry right now when it improves the efficiency. Those technologies can be brought to bear to this problem.
Right, but it does sound to me like the state would have to pay for more inspection power in order for this thing to work. And to Reich's point, that this particular legislature is inclined to spend less, particularly on regulation. Can we really expect effective regulation and policing in this political environment, or must we require it in order to feel safe about fracking?
In my view, there's no point in writing regulations if you don't have enforcement. It's like you said about paying taxes. I think this legislature will understand that, because this legislature, when they formed our body, they did it with a view to protecting the public. So if the protection of the public means an additional boots on the ground, I believe this legislature will, or the public will make them do it.
Richard, what does this struggle look like politically in other states? Have you followed any of the political goings on in other states?
Well, not to this detailed level, but one thing that is interesting is I spoke to someone in industry named Kevin Brown. He's the exploration manager for Whitmar, which is a gas exploration company that's actually leased 5,000 to 6,000 acres in Lee County. And I asked him, when do y'all intend to come to North Carolina? You have these leases. And he said, well, it's going to be several years. And the one thing he wanted to point out is that they need to know that there's a stable, trustworthy legal infrastructure before they come. And the reason is, in New York State, they had fracking, and now they don't. They have a moratorium because environmental issues were raised. So they want to know that not just that we have these regulations, but that they can trust that things are going to stay the way they are.
Do you think, Reich, let me ask you this question. It's a little bit of speculation, but in Florida, for instance, environmental groups immediately rose to oppose fracking once it was first proposed. The legislature began to make moves, particularly towards transparency. The state house yesterday just authorized and required that all of the chemicals in fracking solution be disclosed and transparent. And that seemed to allow the environmental groups to stand down a little bit. Is this a political process that can work? Do you think that in fact we can see a regulatory process and regulatory agencies strong enough in this state to actually make fracking safe?
Well, to make community activists and particularly residents feel comfortable, it's going to take more than just a good regulatory apparatus. It's going to take the ability to actually affirm the value of community involvement and community control. Each community is going to have a different set of concerns. And if a legislature, be it the federal legislature or a state legislature, decides that they need to have uniform policy and override local concerns, you're going to run into problems in each municipality. For example, if you have a county where you are primarily relying on a volunteer firefighting force, and the volunteer firefighting force has at its capacity X volume of foam that is useful in fighting a runaway fire, that means that if you go and overrule the local ability to have any kind of regulation on the location of facilities related to fracking that might cause such a fire, you've just basically told the locals they have to live with a dangerous situation. And that's a problem that has to be addressed by allowing local governments to have meaningful oversight. Now, I do agree with your premise about transparency, which is I definitely believe that a knowledge imbalance always leads to a power imbalance. And when there's a knowledge imbalance, the power imbalance also leads to distrust. So the disclosure piece will definitely help towards establishing and building trust, but that can only actually be finalized if communities are meaningfully involved. And we've had bills introduced on other fronts this session, I don't believe they've yet been passed as law, that would overrule local regulation on a host of on every
there's been
issue.
A lot of that, especially when it comes to school boards and other things that would concentrate more power at the state level.
That's right.
And take away local governance,
even to the extent of gerrymandering local decision making in Wake County, for example.
On the state of things, we're going to come right back and take a break and come right back talking about fracking today. Reich Longest is a clinical professor and director of the Environmental Law and Policy Clinic at Duke. Vikram Rao is Executive Director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium, former Chief Technology Officer at Halliburton, and he's the Chair of the Wastewater Management Commission for the Mining and Energy Consortium, the Mining and Energy Commission here in the state of North Carolina. Richard Ziegler, independent reporter and producer. Our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Continuing our conversation on the future of fracking in North Carolina. Richard Ziegler is with us, independent reporter and producer, recently produced a series for us here at WUNC called Fracking North Carolina. Reich Longest is a clinical professor and director of environmental law and policy clinic at Duke, and Vikram Rao is executive director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium. He's a former chief technology officer at Halliburton, and he chairs the Wastewater Management Commission of the Mining and Energy Commission here in the state of North Carolina. So just before the break, we were talking about sort of empowering localities to make these decisions about their local town or village or city. And you were talking, Reich, about the fact that the state seems to be pulling more and more power away from localities, taking it to Raleigh. Vic, you said that there is at least one mechanism now for the commission to be empowering communities.
Right. So the legislature asked the commission to produce what's called a study group. It's not a rulemaking body, but a study group. And it had a shorter leash. It has a delivery by October of this year. And the delivery is basically this. What are the local impacts from doing this activity? And more particular, the assessment of whether impact fees should be assessed to address them.
And Reich, as you were saying, so that's a way to ascertain the impact and maybe impose fees. But Reich, as you were saying, there's other moves in the legislature that could take that power away, the actual enforcement power away from cities and towns.
That's correct. And I think an important point there, too, is that impact fees are not going to make people whole. All North Carolinians have a right to clean air and clean water. It's one of the things enshrined in our Constitution. It's part of our right as a North Carolinian. And not all of that can be addressed by impact fees. Now, certainly some of the impacts can, and I'm glad that the local impact group is looking into those. But if the legislature empowers the body with one hand and then takes it away in another place, that's really not going to do any benefit to anyone. And it's not going to address the issues of whether or not it's a wise move to trade cheap energy for clean water. North Carolina is blessed in the Southeast with an abundance of clean water, which strategically, as a long-term investment, is, in my view, more valuable than gas.
I want to introduce Elaine Chioso right now. Elaine is the Haw River Keeper and Executive Director of the Haw River Assembly. Elaine, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So how do you approach this question of fracking as a river keeper?
Right. So obviously very concerned about the water issues. And I actually represent the rest of the water keepers in North Carolina. So we're all really working to keep fracking from coming to North Carolina. And I'm part of the umbrella group called Frack Free NC, which is organizations across the state working against fracking. So we basically believe you cannot make rules to make fracking safe here or anywhere. And my own observations have been that if it was possible to actually make those regulations and enforce them, it would be much too expensive to extract this fuel.
We haven't talked yet about the potential impact on clean water. We've talked about the wastewater and how to dispose of it. So what's your concern about the fresh water in the state?
Well, first of all, where are we going to get this fresh water? Talks with the Army Corps of Engineers have made it pretty clear that our major reservoirs, including Carr Lake, Jordan Lake, Falls Lake, that water's been allocated. There really is not extra water in our lakes. And if you look at the record of droughts, we know that it happens pretty often in North Carolina. So we're pretty concerned about that, and especially against a backdrop of having very poor riparian right rules in North Carolina. We basically allow people to take water out of streams wherever they want to with the trigger for enforcement of stopping that when there's a drought is so small that we could be in big trouble quickly with droughts and taking water out of our streams.
Well, Vic, Elaine made 2 points there. Let's start with the last one. Do we have enough water? What happens if we start drawing all this water and putting it into
Right. Well, first of all, she's right about the riparian rights, and the committee is particularly looking at that, and this will be one industry that will not be allowed to do that without a permit. So any permit for doing drilling will be accompanied by a water permit, in which case, and we will be specifying withdrawal rates and so forth. So that is a bit of a safeguard in the sense that there will be permit. We will have DENR overlooking it, and they have given us some expert testimony on how best to do that. But a parenthetical separate point, this is relatively new technology, but industry doesn't need fresh water for fracking. It does not need fresh water. So one of the things we're trying to write the rules for right now is we'll require every operator who's applying for a permit to say, what other water bodies have they considered and why have you not considered non-fresh water? So, for example, what could that be? It could be gray water from a municipality. It could be salt water from anywhere, from the sea, from what are known as saline aquifers. So this can be done technically, is not being done very much, but we are going to force the issue to at least say, prove to us you can't do it.
Well, what if they prove to you it just would cost them more and they don't like to spend more money? Would they be able to go ahead and...
Yeah, so we have not written those rules yet. No. We're trying to sort out how do we put in incentives or whether it's a carrot or a stick. But here's the deal. Reusing the frack water will help a lot. Okay. Now, not all of it comes back, but the part that comes back, that means that's how much fresh you don't have to use, especially because our return water will not be as salty as in the Marcellus. But beyond that, we've not really sorted through how do we incentivize the use. We will certainly be asking for that information, but we haven't figured out how to make it more likely to happen.
Every time, though, we talk about making it safer, we do hear some more built-in costs. Elaine's point, it's going to be cost prohibitive. If you really make it safe, they're not going to be able to afford it. Do you feel that way then?
Actually not. I don't feel that way, particularly because industry will raise that as a bugaboo to say we don't want to do something. Industry rarely wants to do something different from what they're doing. The philosophy of it ain't broke, let's not fix it. Well, as it turns out, that it kind of depends upon what level of cleanup, for example. This is happening in other places. So actually, I don't agree, but I do, because the profit margins to be made in this industry will support environmentally correct behavior.
Well, Elaine, what makes you think this is such a new industry, this horizontal part of fracking anyway? Why do you think it's impossible to find a cost-effective way to do this safely?
We've seen such a record of violations in other states where it's going on, groundwater being contaminated, the surface waters even being polluted, and a lot of that was illegal activity. Do we want to invite illegal activity into North Carolina? And even the question of saying, the Mining and Energy Commission saying, well, we'll make the industry have permits to draw fresh water. Who's going to watch them? Who's going to be out watching those trucks? I mean, I've been working for the environment, you know, for the Hall River Assembly for 30 years. I have seen a lot of pollution. I sat on the Sedimentation and Erosion Control Commission for the state for 8 years. There we have real regulations in place. We even have local control. I have seen so few big development projects that have actually gone to completion without getting a notice of violation. And that's in an industry where we know how to do it right. I'm afraid that the amount of human error, either caused by accident or greed, is just too big to risk this.
Well, and all of that happened in an environment where there was a government that believed in government, believed in regulation.
That's true.
And again, I think politically the winds are shifting. So I suppose it's fair to speculate what would happen if you actually reduced the amount of regulatory oversight that we have now, when all of that happened at the height and peak of our regulatory concern. Let me turn to a different subject. Richard, you talked about something in your piece called compulsory pooling. Tell us what that is.
Well, compulsory pooling is the idea that the state has the right to manage how oil and gas are extracted in order to prevent waste, mostly is the rationale behind it. Now, when people come to do hydraulic fracturing, they're going to be asked to have a minimum amount of acreage per well. And that can be a lot. In some states, that might be 640 acres. If they can't get enough voluntary aggregation of land and enough voluntary pooling, then the gas operator may be able to petition the state to force somebody who's contiguous with them, their land's contiguous with them, to come in and be a part of the drilling unit so they can do hydraulic fracturing there too.
So we're on this big plot of land, 11 landowners, 10 of us say, yeah, go ahead and frack, we'll sell our rights. Number 11 says, no, you've got critical mass here. The gas company goes to the state, says, make number 11 say yes. And they must.
Right, right, right.
All right. And so, and there have been hearings about this, and people have testified, and some people are a little bit upset about that. Let's listen to what happened.
There's people, sir, like myself, that refuse to sign a lease.
Do you realize that forced pooling has been on the books since 1945? Right. That the so Mining and Energy Commission?
In 1945, we weren't talking about fracking.
All right, so there's some of the contention here. What's the rationale behind this that I can, as a state, force you to sell your rights?
Well, this goes back to the 1930s and 40s, and the rationale is, like I said, that the state has the right through its police powers to make sure there is no waste when gas or oil are extracted. Now, to really understand why that is an issue, you have to go back to the 1920s when there was a lot of loose oil exploration and production, and the kind of pace of the oil boom back then was outpacing regulation. And there weren't many laws regarding how it was done. So what you would have is somebody puts down a vertical well and taps a reservoir that's under their property, but it's also under your property. And they're sucking oil out of it, and they're getting all, because of the laws back then, they're getting all of the benefit and all the profits. Well, the neighbor is going to come around and say, that's not fair. Well, without compulsory pooling, the only remedy he had was what they call self-help. So he would put in an oil well too. And pretty soon there's an oil well every 5 feet, which for environmental reasons, people don't like it. But also with every drilling point, the pressure in the reservoir goes down, so that you are less able to get oil or gas out of it, which means there's actual waste. There's actual resource in the reservoir rock that cannot come out now. And the government back then, partly because they were concerned, the government was concerned about having enough energy to fund industry, I mean, to power industry. Mm-hmm. Private companies were worried about the instability of prices. So they all agreed that the state has the right to force people into one drilling unit so that you can only have one, so that you would have one well drilling that whole reservoir,
so
for example.
It protected individuals' rights as well.
Right.
But this is a different kind of mining. That was Ed Harris we heard in that clip,
right?
And he's been holding his own community meetings as well. Can you tell us, Elaine, a little bit about him and the meetings that he's held and some of what he's turned
out? Right. So we are just in, I'd say just in this past 6 months, we're really starting to see people in Lee County, which would be the real focal point of fracking probably, at least when it gets started, if it does, in North Carolina. And so people are learning more and more about what the risks are, finding out perhaps they don't own their mineral rights. We haven't talked about that yet, the split estates where people have a house on the surface. They thought they owned their mineral rights. They're just realizing now that they didn't, because this wasn't something people thought about in North Carolina. So Lee County has just done a they've actually put together a database showing who owns their mineral rights, and people are getting surprised. And in fact, across the state, we're finding a lot of places where people don't own their mineral rights because timber companies kept them when they sold that land to developers. So this is a whole other issue. If you don't own your mineral rights, a gas company can come and frack on your land without your permission, because they own the mineral rights.
They find somebody, the landlord, who may not be anywhere near.
Yes, you could just be renting. Even.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to also talk a little bit about what was said in the clip about the fact that this has been on the books since 1945. Another very important piece that's also been on the books since 1945 is the ability to control production. So there was a regulated monopoly that was set up where at that point the commission that was in charge of oil and gas regulation would not only allow this forced pooling to take place, but would actually regulate production, so there would not be overproduction. It would maximize profitability for all users. What's being proposed now is to keep the forced pooling but to deregulate production. And so you can have a situation where an owner may want to hold out waiting for the price of gas to get above 10 cubic feet or whatever. And that is going to be swept under the rug, as I see it, in the way that we're going forward. We're going to remove the cap on production, allow gas to be developed, which may be profitable for segments of the industry or components of a company, but may not maximize profit for the individual landowner who may want to participate but may want to wait until they've grown up and their kids have moved off the land.
So it turns that original regulation on its head, essentially.
Correct.
Well, Elaine, I've got time for one more, and I want to ask you, this business of being on rented property, not only might you not own the mineral rights, but in a lot of places, particularly in poorer areas of the state where this might be done, people are renting, so their landlord, who doesn't live there, gets to profit,
right,
and you have whatever environmental fallout.
Right. As is true with a lot of environmental issues, this is an environmental justice issue as well. We're going to see people who have the least power and are the poorest, not profiting from fracking, but bearing a lot of the risks. Their groundwater could be contaminated. They could be living with truck traffic at an unbelievable level going by their houses, an industrialized landscape, lights and noise all day and night. And, you know, we haven't talked about the alternative here. We have an amazing solar and wind industry in North Carolina without much help from the state of North Carolina. But there are regulations that are helping it that are, again, in this legislature, we're looking at taking those away. We haven't talked about deep underground injection, which is in the new Senate Bill 76, which is a very scary thing and frightening the coast about injecting the polluted frack wastewater under their aquifers. It failed back in the 70s when they did this. People don't want to see it happening again.
I wish we had more time, but we are out. I want to thank all of my guests for being on the program today. Elaine Chioso is the Haw River Keeper and Executive Director of the Haw River Assembly. Vikram Rao is Executive Director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium, and he is the chair of a committee of the Mining and Energy Commission here in the state of North Carolina. Reich Longest is a clinical professor and director of the Environmental Law and Public Policy Clinic at Duke. Richard Ziegler is an independent reporter and producer who produced our series here at WUNC called Fracking North Carolina. That's our program. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.